start of the day, we've got a piece from the Obsidian Prism Duo here. Obsidian is a visual artist and researcher in postcolonial theory, culture, and education. She is taking a black quantum Afrofuturist approach towards tackling issues of racism, cultural appropriation, intersectionality, and sustainable urban regeneration by drawing on an image of a global black culture. Prism is a musician and visual artist specializing in rainbow goth, sound design, and crafting analog double exposure captures. She is based in Berlin and responds to the inspiration of memory, saturation, and a dream world. The text to their piece, Bird Clock Opera with text from Days of the Week, were originally written as a part of a revision of the Homeric hymn to Demeter, a revision which broadens the picture of black women who are descendant of colonial enslavement. The underlying track is a piece based on the sounds of childhood as remembered and incorporated into this collaborative soundscape.
Hello, we are Prism Obsidian, a visual arts meets sound design duo in Berlin, who composed a piece for Radio Play. The texts for this piece were originally written by Obsidian as a partial revision of the Homeric hymn to Demeter, a revision which broadens the picture of black women who are descendant of colonial enslavement. A dialogue based on the contrast of Artemis's power and agency over her body compared to women who have been unsafe for generations. Women who carry these wounds as warnings and a call out for accountability. The underlying track, called Zerkathalon's Debut, a Bird Clock Opera, is a piece written by Prism, based on the sounds of childhood, as remembered and incorporated into this collaborative soundscape. Obsidian is a visual artist and researcher in postcolonial theology, culture, and education. She is taking a black quantum Afrofuturist approach towards tackling issues of racism, cultural appropriation, intersectionality, and sustainable urban regeneration by drawing on an image of global black cultures. Prism is a musician and a visual artist specializing in rainbow goth sound design and crafting analog double exposure captures. She responds to the inspiration of memory, saturation, and the dream world. The following reading begins with Razan Blaj, a text written by Haitian-American anthropologist Dr. Gina Athena Ulysses. Then we move on to the three pieces written by Obsidian. Please enjoy.
Sound. while unsmacking the lips will propel the blue surrounding the depressed ah again, ending with je. Play with its contours. Know what this word feels like in your mouth. In Haitian Creole, three syllables. Ra, zon, blage. Razon blage, razon blage, razon blage.
Thank you. The hounds of Actium. The city, Athens, was the epicenter of life. Art, literature, philosophy, and democracy flourished here, in Athens. Philosophers such as Socrates and Plato bided here, as did playwrights such as Sophocles and Euripides. Athens, like all Greek cities, marked the boundaries between the realm of humans and the divine. There was no need to stray or risk venturing further. The uncertainty of returning from potentially non-existent liminal spaces was not to be risked. In so doing, crossing, one risked the displeasure of the gods. Human attempts at conquering the wilderness were considered an attempt at warring with the gods. The wise hunter views the forest with the wary respect of a worthy adversary. As an opponent, the forest threatens the hunter's livelihood and potentially wields the capacity to threaten mortality through the dangers of the hunt. The hunter, Actaeon, fell prey to the deadly mythical forces which inhabited the forest. Artemis is the virgin. In ancient Athenian myth and religion, Artemis is the goddess of the hunt, the wilderness, wild animals, the moon, and of chastity, childbirth, and midwifery. Artemis is a daughter of Zeus and Leto, a twin to the god Apollo, and in so being, she is beyond the merriment of the goddess Aphrodite. In ancient Athenian mythology and religion, Aphrodite is the goddess associated with beauty, love, passion, pleasure, and procreation. Artemis both punishes for the loss of chastity, whilst also, according to Hippolytus, being known to relieve the pains of laboring women in childbirth. Her eternal virginity is honored by the adornment of her crown, consisting of untouched flowers from the meadow, nurtured by water that is as pure as she. Artemis is also the goddess of the hunt and the mistress of wild, untamed nature. Actaeon had been warned. All of humanity had been warned against the wilds of nature. Actaeon's ruin, like that of Daenerys, was caused by ignorance resulting from credulity. Credulity, which came largely from an inborn natural trait, which was governed by the universal human psychological characteristic of neglecting the unfavorable possibility and relying on the favorable one. In his youthful exuberance and possible arrogance, Actaeon wandered far from home. Far from the bounds of the city's protective gates, beyond the gates of the city, Actaeon continued, farther afield, beyond the farms, the pastures, and the prairies where the animals grazed and sustenance for the city was provided for. Actaeon continued onwards, towards the wild, darkness of the woods. Despite the warnings, Actaeon scorned the superstitious prohibitions against the woods and entered. Lured onwards by the sounds of the nymphs and the smell of water for his hounds, Actaeon pushed forward. Would you drink it if she leads you to that blue water? The thickness of the forest closed in around him as he moved deeper and deeper into the wood. What led Dinara, Phaedra, and Oedipus to their fatal choices in critical moments? Was it unrestrained passion or the restless urge of desires? It was rather the universal human weakness of believing what seemed to be facts, not so much because they are demonstrably true, as because we want to believe them. Was this Eros, or the same impulse which led Actaeon to his ruin? To the minds of the ancient Greeks, the moment Actaeon left the safety of the city's walls, he was courting danger. When Actaeon came upon the goddess Artemis and her nymphs, he incurred her wild fury. Artemis's rage at the effrontery of Actaeon's mortal intrusion upon the realm of the divine did not go unpunished. As Artemis' stature rose in view of her fury at being spied upon by lustful human eyes, Actaeon took flight. As he ran through the thick brush of the forest, the bones of his body fell apart and grew back together again, not as a human, but in the form of a stag. With antlers through his skull and the voice of a beast, he alerted his 50 hounds to the presence of the hunted. The excitement of the hunt quickened throughout the pack. Actaeon is transformed. The laws of democracy, order, and civilization were transposed with the unknown, tenuous wants of the wild. This realm was beyond his control. His hounds no longer knew the scent of their master. Their loyalty was replaced with the call to the hunt. The hounds of Actaeon descended upon their master and devoured him. This was not the viciousness of nature. It was divine order. I'd get myself to school, either from the bus stop, up the bend and around the corner from the house, or I'd leave by way of the porch Daddy and I had built together that first summer of the Chrysler lamps. That must have been the summer of 1900 and I don't know what. It was the same summer that the neighbors gave me a pair of roller skates, the ones with which I ruined the only pair of jeans I'd ever been allowed to wear. We don't wear that kind of pants. That was why Mama must have let me skate up and down the street in them. Every time I fell, it was near some part of pavement where tar was bubbling up in the hot, humid 100 plus degree air. When I fell, I'd sometimes lie myself flat out on my belly and stare at the tiny mounds until they heated up with enough gas to bubble. When the bubble arose, I'd press it back into the thick, sludgy stream of tar. Up and down I went all day, until I'd learned to skate properly. And those jeans were covered in tar. They were ruined. Tar could not enter the washing machine. The jeans could no longer be disgracefully worn. Although Mama bragged to everyone about how I wouldn't stop skating that day until I'd learned how to do it well enough to do a figure eight. Often, Daddy brought us younger ones with him when he went wandering off on his own. Sissy says that he must have known that there was something wrong with Mama. He followed the signs, noting when the occasion had arrived, when it was unwise to leave me alone with Mama. Now that I am older, I notice that there were many tasks I saw my daddy perform that the other fathers never did. At church, at home, and around town, he often spoke of the roles and responsibilities which were appropriate to men versus women. But at home, he often performed his as well as Mama's duties. During the summer of I can't remember when, Daddy had nothing else to do. So when we'd have enough gas money to drive to the store instead of walking, we'd go by the junkyard. For weeks, we spent the better part of our days gathering up the scrap lumber as it came in. Sonny, Daddy, and I would fill up the back and top rack of that old station wagon with random bits of lumber. The junkyard was out in Little Africa, where the roads were tricky and winding. Sometimes, Daddy had to drive so slowly when the car was weighted down extra heavy. He'd let me run along the side of the path, down the hill, picking flowers, throwing stones, or hopping on one leg to see how long it took me to get tired. Once we left Little Africa, the roads were paved properly, and he could drive at a normal speed. So I'd have to climb atop the lumber that had found itself all the way up to where I was meant to be seated and excuse myself, as I would a tree if I had accidentally hit it, stepped on its roots, or broken off a branch in haste. Stripping these randomly assorted planks back to their essence became a labor of love and devotion for us. Daddy said we'd have to protect the wood now. It was weak. Sensing that the tree might be lonely for its leaves, I suggested we paint it green. The bits that were fire damaged, he let me burn some more so I could have charcoal to draw with. I held things in place or used the hammer as we fixed a porch off the back of the kitchen door. Some mornings, particularly in the spring, daydreaming got the better of me as I sat at the window looking out at how the trees shook when a flock of birds took flight, or how the light changed a passerby's reflection in a window or puddle. Those days, I'd miss just right meant that I'd not have to stand at the bus stop with the other kids, or to miss it altogether. If I had to stand with them for more than a few breaths, they'd replace my name with the N-word, or I'd get poked or made fun of for my hand-me-down clothes, or for talking like the folks in Little Africa, even though I didn't. Mama would not allow that. I never spoke. They had no idea what my voice sounded like. If they'd known me, they'd have heard language that was spoken on the news or public broadcasting TV. Some mornings, I missed the bus because I was undecided as to whether this was a good day to be at school or not. Some days, I'd just sit there looking out the window all day until my older siblings came home from school and threw me out of doors into the fresh air and wanderings. But some days, I was indecisive because the Greek goddess Selene had invited Psyche in to sprinkle my thoughts with a healthy dose of abulomania, rendering me pathologically indecisive. These mornings, I'd change my mind after the bus had already done been and gone. I'd race through the kitchen, across the porch, down the stairs, and across the backyard, towards the fence by the apple trees and the farmer's orchard behind the house, climb the fence and make my way towards the brook, leading into the deep, dark depths of the forest we were warned against. In the forest, I was free to roam. But that stopped once I began to see what waited there for others beneath the canopy of the trees.
Thank you.
like walking home together. We liked it until the forest changed for her. Now there is a prohibition against the forest. But there has never been any mention of why. But I do know why, although I can never say. I know why, because I saw it happen. Apart from this man, you cannot lead him astray. He is an enemy to you and to those who follow you and love what you desire. For behold, the vesture which in heaven was formerly yours has been set aside for him, and the mortality which was his has been transferred to you. This is from the Apocalypse of Abraham. I liked these stories. At the heart of them, there was a truth, which the Bible, as I was being taught it, was clearly lacking. These were about real people in real places like Sumer and Babylonia. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. A dream which read like my sister's mad visions. 10. Thus were the vision of mine head and my bed. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. 11. The tree grew and was strong, all and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of the earth. 12. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof. All flesh was fed of it. 13. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and an holy one came down from heaven. My sister spoke these words to me from the book of Daniel, as she shooed me forward to climb to the highest heights of the maple tree. In this realm of the sacred virgin, Sissy had the keen sense of hearing reserved for the true huntress. I barely heard the whoosh of the parting leaves as the hounds approached. As Artemis must have sensed the approach of Actaeon, so too did my sister respond to the change in our surroundings as the hounds neared. My sister, now with the imagined stature of Artemis, then reminded me not to look, and to wrap my body with leaves, as Eve had once hidden her nakedness from God. Garden of Eden. Seven. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Eight. And they heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God amongst the trees of the garden. 9. And the Lord God called unto Adam and said unto him, Where art thou? I asked her if she would say it exactly as I had just recited. shied away, hurt that I had not been praised for promptly calling forth and applying months of memorized verses. I knew I'd be left to myself with no one to play with tonight. She told me not to look until she called for me, and we would carry onwards towards home. Mama and Daddy spoke of there being strange fruit in the woods when they were children. Tarred, like the ground I skated on. But I had only seen it hanging in postcard images. Because of our tamies, virgins are safe in the wood. Why then was my sister not safe? Spying upon our tamies and her nymphs. It's the other children. I am not the only one for whom conventions meant nothing. Yet, unlike me, these other children's natures were as vicious and blind when set free in the wild. Saw them become aware of the scent of prey and fear and prance forward. Some sprang to the chase, others stopped methodically. My sister had called them to the hunt with the scent of her fear. She ran, her feet as light as the wind on autumn's leaves. Finally,
this marks the conclusion of the trilogy, so thank you for listening so far. Now, we will give a short talk about the context and meaning behind Obsidian's pieces. So, the first piece, The Hounds of Actaeon, you say, human attempts at conquering the wilderness were considered an attempt at warring with the gods. Now, I know from working with you that one of the themes you discuss heavily is decolonization. Is it accurate to say that this quote about humans warring with the gods touches on the subject?
Colonialization is a war between resources, materials, and human labor for the benefit of a small percentage financially. In the process of colonizing, we've created a great environmental, social, and spiritual deficit, which is the same as warring against the gods.
Wow, okay. One of the other things that stands out to me in that piece is the contrast between the Greek myth and the story you tell about your sister. Artemis's rage at the effrontery Artemis's rage at the effrontery of Actaeon's mortal intrusion upon the realm of the divine did not go unpunished. There was no god or goddess to come in and save your sister. How in the modern world would you like there to be punishment for the metaphorical hounds?
Just normal legal action, due course for inappropriate behavior, and taking our rights as those embodied in black female bodies seriously as those who perpetrate against us, whatever their gender or race. That's all I ask.
Yeah, it seems pretty fair, but definitely not obvious, unfortunately.
Not obvious, and also unpredictable as to when one has stepped into an urban treehouse full of woods metaphors and woods wisdom. It is unexpected to experience violations which go unanswered.
Yeah, you can't always protect yourself all the time. That's exhausting.
You cannot, yet when we think colonially, my ancestors have been doing that for hundreds of years of American enslavement, Jim Crow, New Jim Crow. So I guess you can, and I think you can even turn it into an art form, but the damage is great. The damage is too much, but you can. I think you can do anything.
So I think that touches on something else, the concept of divine order. I remember you saying, this was not the viciousness of nature, it was divine order. You said that that was a line written in sarcasm. Can you talk more about that?
Oh, yeah. My little jokes are peppered throughout the text, and this is one of my favorites. This was not the viciousness of nature, it was divine order. Well, which would be vicious? Divine order allowed that peoples on the African continent who were not Christians could be enslaved. That was literally an order from the church, justifying colonial enslavement. Nature will have a forest fire which will put itself out over time. Colonial enslavement, if your mother is a slave, you're born a slave. Sometimes it can be so frustrating to note these things that a little bit of humor really helps me get through creating these types of texts.
Yeah, it makes me think about learning the concept of manifest destiny in my own upbringing. We're both Americans. We're both from the United States.
And we're both Southerners, technically.
Yep. And I just remember that was hammered in my head that it would provide the justification for what the colonizers did in the U.S. to make the land theirs. And this is not exactly the same thing, but close. And how I was always just like, that's incredible that there needed to be some sort of justification, you know? Like, why did they get to be so entitled?
It was a legal trail. It was an incredibly clever device that we have known for hundreds of years is an effective way of colonizing peoples. It's the reason why, despite the end of enslavement in many African nations, all of the land, all of the resources are owned by former colonials. Pieces of paper have a lot of power. Although they're made of the wood that the forest can burn down at any point with enough kindling.
Wow. When you put it that way, it just seems like maybe we should do some burning.
Is this why we're anonymous?
Yes. This is why we're anonymous. The next piece we're going to talk about is mornings. And I want to touch on the pants topic when you say, we don't wear that kind of pants. Can you talk about, like, who is the we in this and the kind of pants is jeans? Why don't we wear these kind of pants?
Little girl jeans with butterflies embroidered on the seats.
Mm-hmm.
It's not modest. It's drawing attention to the young female body in a way that one would draw attention to an adult female's body. It's the same cut. It's the same style. It's the same politics for a grown woman on a child's body. The innocence of a child is something that should be protected. The innocence of a girl child is something that in our part of the world has not been protected very well for a long time. So in my mother's idea of what was right and wrong, things that make a child look like a woman are wrong. And so I don't know if it was her way around it was to let me have them and let me learn how to roller skate at the same time on a hot sunny day with dripping tar.
Mm-hmm.
But it replaced the desire to skip childhood with an accomplishment and a memory that still makes me twirl around the room like a butterfly when I think about roller skating in the summer or hot bubbling tar and laying on my belly and pressing the bubbles down.
That's a really nice memory. And I'm thinking about how different our childhoods were. I did have an opportunity to be on wheels, but not on roller skates, because I lived on top of a hill. I would always be riding my bike. Right? But I didn't have an issue of pants growing up, mostly because I went to a private school where the girls weren't even allowed to wear pants. We had to wear kilts and jumpers, and the boys were the ones that got to wear the pants. So I think my childhood would have been different if this had been a conversation about what I was allowed to wear versus what I was not allowed to wear. Because when I wasn't in school and I was playing, my mom encouraged me to choose whatever it was that I wanted. So individuality was really important because I didn't have the opportunity to be an individual when I was wearing a uniform, which was supposed to, you know,
stop conflicts.
Yeah, I was supposed to say that, like, okay, you know, there might be some income bracket differences at the school, but I didn't do it. I mean, that didn't do it. Like, there were still definitely ways to tell.
And the distraction of clothing.
Oh, yeah. But
I think that our mothers had some of the same restrictions put on them by society. My mother's concern was my not being sexualized because we've been sexualized for so long.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was also really concerned with being an active part in shaping me because there were so many stronger influences than, you know, this tiny 5'3" woman coming my way.
Mm-hmm.
And your mother had a different fight based on where she came from and the scars that it left. So it had to be tackled differently, even beyond race.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was always going to be a weirdo. She kind of knew that. And so I think that's why she encouraged me to be individualistic, even with my clothing choice, because she knew that to stifle that, I would just probably end up way worse than dealing with the conflict early on, like recognizing that you might end up not having any friends at this private school, but you will be educated, but you need to make that decision now, you know? Like, what do you do when you get made fun of? You know, do you end up being just like them or do you end up being yourself? So, but yeah.
Yeah.
This other thing that you spoke of about your father's roles, I thought was really interesting when you said at church, at home, and around town, he often spoke of the roles and responsibilities which were appropriate for men versus women. But at home, he often performed his as well as mama's duties. Why? Why did he do this?
I think that part of our safety in community definitely goes back to colonial enslavement. And the church had several functions. One function was it helped abolish colonial enslavement in the U.S. Another function was it helped colonize us. It replaced our indigenous beliefs and ancestral beliefs with the colonizers, and we had to obey and conform to these as part of the act of removing our pasts and making us malleable. But then following the abolishment of slavery, the church was still quite important because we weren't safe. We needed a community, and that was the structure under which our political movements were run. And so I think especially men in my father's generation, you know, he's in his 80s,
mm-hmm.
were very much aware of the rhetoric that they needed to recite no matter what the situation was. Because they also knew that very few people were really looking at us. Like we see in another one of my short pieces that my skin had gone red, I was going in anaphylactic shock. And the nurse just wasn't really looking or thinking enough at what does red look like on brown red skin?
Mm-hmm.
So if he's saying the words, people are gonna be assuming that that's how things are. But it wasn't. We didn't have the same gender roles. We didn't have the same gender expectations. And my mother was often unwell mentally, and that played out physically for her, and my father picked up the pieces.
Yeah, you do say in another piece, like, how strong the love was between your parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was repulsive. I mean, ugh, like, things like my father standing up and, you know, saying, oh yes, thank you to the lovely blah 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 in reference to my mother, like absolute adoration. You know, he dresses her grave so passionately and delicately and with so much flair and style that, yeah, they were really in love with one another. And it was repulsive.
Yeah, but I mean, that can give you such a foundation of what family means.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Family and community.
Mm-hmm.
Like their love for one another, I think, was matched by their commitment to their roles in the community and dragging us around with them. I mean, it's often spoken upon in this European and British context that I live in that I keep a pretty tight community.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised with that. I don't know anything else. If these are your people, these are your people. You have to look after, make sure they know that you're thinking about them. And if any opportunities arise, make sure that they're the very first to receive them. This is what you do. If someone's not well, you take care of them. If someone's happy, you celebrate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of love that he had for her was based on coming from a community where that was always a given.
Hmm. Speaking of community, you talk about a place called Little Africa. So is that a name that was labeled with resentment or with pride or... Yeah, talk to me about Little Africa.
Well, the Black community did not name it Little Africa.
Right. But yet it's still used.
Yes, and there was a pretty thick indigenous population up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of poor PWT, as we call it. You can look that up. We're not going to say it. Yeah, it was considered Little Africa. Long, winding roads, jungle of trees. And we just kind of appropriated it. You know, just like the N-word, which has become a multi-billion dollar a year industry. Black folks have a way of kind of running with the insults and playing with them and rhyming with them and seeing, well, what can we do with this? So, yeah, Little Africa was potentially a place of shame, but it was transformed. It was a lovely place to be a little girl.
Hmm. Yeah, and speaking again of being a little girl and choosing where to go, so when you're talking about, okay, so this quote, for example, but some days I was indecisive because the Greek goddess Selene had invited Psyche in to sprinkle my thoughts with a healthy dose of abelomania, rendering me pathologically indecisive. These mornings I changed my mind after the bus had already done been gone. I'd race through the kitchen, across the porch, down the stairs, and across the backyard towards the fence by the apple trees in the farmer's orchard behind the house, climb the fence, and make my way towards the brook leading into the deep, dark depths of the forest we were warned against. In the forest I was free to roam, but that stopped once I began to see what waited for others beneath the canopy of the trees. So this whole concept struck me because truancy, like me as a white person, you know, if I didn't go to school, I would be punished.
Your education was important to society.
God, that's so tragic.
I was meant for jail, prostitution, drug dealing, or to be, what, a crack hoe? I mean, like, you know, the lower stage of prostitution. Yes. My parents, I mean, my father left education before the age of 11, and when it was crop time, there was no consideration of going to school. Mm-hmm. So, being a Texan, if there was some kind of athletic event, they'd want all of the darkies from the farms to come in and show their talented skills to help the team win, but they could go back to the fields. Other than that, nobody cared about their educations. My mother went to Catholic schools, so she had a quite strict educational upbringing, but also she had quite a distant mother.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was not all that well, so no one was really looking after my mother's education. And I have the feeling that my mother probably approached her education the same way that I did. If maybe it's a good day today, maybe it's not a good day. And sometimes, oh, oops, yeah, but I better go. And find a way of making it magical, like, you know, traipsing through the forest. My truancy was also my way of managing the damage.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced so much racialized violence, sexual exploitation, exclusion in school. It wasn't something I could really do on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Even as a child who had incredibly tough skin because of racial situations, I couldn't do that more than three times on the average week. And if I did do it more than three times, it was because I just spent the whole day in the library. It wasn't until I was a teenager and I was no longer truant alone that it became a problem. And I was truant with white kids whose parents assumed that I was what was poisoning their children.
Yeah, because there's no way that their special privileged children could ever have been truant on their own.
No, not the rich kids I was hanging out with.
Yeah.
who really taught me the ropes of the best way to spend a truant day. It was delightful. I had friends, and we were going to museums and the zoo where I could draw all day. It was fantastic. I loved it.
So, and now we're getting to the section, raped.
Raped.
And you go, actually, you take great lengths to not make it graphic. And I think if people weren't listening closely enough, they may have missed what happened. Because you describe it, I hate to say it, but beautifully.
Thank you.
I know, but it's I know that's what you do too. Like, you take something dark and you try to transform it. So when you say, my sister, now the imagined stature of Artemis, then reminded me not to look and to wrap my body with leaves as Eve had once hidden her nakedness from God in the Garden of Eden. This is a stark difference between you and your sister here. Your sister is asking for God for help, but you're watching a myth unfold before you. What are you thinking in this instance?
I have spent a large portion of my life inside a magical realism that's fairly unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely began in childhood. I grew up going to church 5 times a week. Like, my upbringing was strict. I still can remember all of the books of the Bible and who wrote them, etc. But already as a child, when I received this copy of Man the Myth Maker, it was a little more palatable and digestible. It was something that I could make more sense of.
Mm-hmm.
It was much more organic. And it wasn't as vengeful. It was pretty vengeful, but, you know, potato, potato, kind mm-hmm. of. And I think my sister understood, well, I think you have different types of people in the Black community for how we handle trauma. My sister understood that assimilation was a great way. I, like you, was just way too much of a weirdo to ever assimilate, you know. So that wasn't an option. What was an option was really diving into my magical realism and also to stay connected to my family and to my siblings, especially because there were so many moments like these. Wow. I had to find a way to soften the harshness of what it meant to be Eve in this instance. And so I don't think I was really thinking anything. I think that, as you know, I'm a bit slow to process emotions. I have a cognitive process. I'm neurodivergent, and I have a cognitive process that sometimes might have me snapping 6 months later about something someone said to me, and you'll be like, yeah, that was really bad, as if it had happened yesterday, because you're used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I wrote this piece, when I wrote this trilogy, I wrote it in a couple of hours. It was really fast. And then I maybe edited it once or twice before it was published. And then I never looked at it again until we were doing the radio show. And I was like, oh, this is great. We can do this with a bird clock and blah, blah, blah. And not really thinking about, well, I'm handing you some audio from walks in nature around the farm. You're taking your sacred bird clock and we're putting it together to talk about rape.
Yeah.
It didn't dawn on me until I was devastated after we did the readings.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because I remember when we got to this section, you know, and I'm doing the sound design for this, sitting there thinking, is it really appropriate that I've got this 4-on-the-floor house beat underneath it, you know? Like, it's the culmination And so I remember, because the original piece, it does get really dancey. So I'm like, well, I need still that rhythm, but I don't want to be like disrespectful of the moment. But I'm like, no, but it's also really intense.
Yes. And it's dogs.
Yeah.
It's a pack of hounds. Mm-hmm. There is a beat.
Yeah.
There is a pulse. This is the pulse of life. It's the pulse of life flowing out.
Mm.
It's the cruelest death possible, really. And I feel like that's absolutely appropriate. It brought them... I don't want to call it merriment of these boy children, these boy young boy rapists. I wouldn't call them merry, but it's something adjacent to that. You know, this is a party for them. They're on the hunt.
Ugh, yeah. And you know, rape happens all the time with other animals too. Like it's mm-hmm. unfortunate. It's a part of nature as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what shocks me and surprises me is that I've heard people talk more about swan rape than the rape of black girls by white children, which is still quite a thing.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that makes some people too uncomfortable to talk about. So they replace that with something that we can supposedly all agree upon, that, you know, oh, animal rape is so evil and so bad. And it's like, but we do it ourselves, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in not being graphic in my depiction, first off, I could never be graphic about this. So it would kill me. It would be impossible. And I think that it would reduce the piece to something that could be exploited in a way that I would just find horrific.
Mm-hmm. So the last thing we're going to talk about is the concept of safety and virginity. When you say, because of Artemis, virgins are safe in the wood. But are they? And why are some safe and not others?
Yeah. Again, that's ironic sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a bit of truth in it. Yes, there are virgins who are safe in the forest. When my children were going to the Rudolf Steiner School, and they'd go do their stupid panurethmic shit out in the forest, and, you know, everybody's safe and in love with the trees, and I would just be like, I'm not going in there. You know, there's no way.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids are safe. It's their mythology that it's a safe place. You know, it's their Lord of the Rings where the Ents come out to save the planet. You know, it's safe for them. And any other conversation, they're not going to hear. So, for me, it's never been safe. For me, those moments of pauses in truancy where I better jump out the back porch and run through the forest to take the shortcut to school, that's a lost memory of a time that even now I don't think I would go into an unknown wood alone or necessarily with a group, because their experience of safety often has the potential to make my life unsafe by their inability to see the dangers.
Mm-hmm.
And their inability to stand up and protect me if those dangers do me harm.
Hmm. Okay. Wow. Thank you for the heaviness.
And thank you for the rainbow god.
Yeah. Thank you for your informative answers. That's all I have for you today.
Thank you very much.
If anyone has any questions, now would be the time to ask them.
Welcome back for the Q&A. So I have a few questions for you. So first of all, what inspired you to create this piece of art? Can you tell us a little bit about the process of how it came to be? Oh, sorry. Let me say it again.
Thank you.
let me ask you about the process and what inspired you. How did this piece, amazing piece of art, come to be?
Yeah, sure. I can answer that question. So I'm Prism, and I'm speaking on behalf of Obsidian right now, who is driving to a very important appointment. How this process happened was, I've been working with Obsidian for some years now. I'm the primary documenter on some of her other projects. And she does a lot of things, and one of them is write. She's a prolific writer, and I'm a prolific musician. She mentioned a long time ago, like 2 years ago, that she had been looking for somebody to create soundscapes underneath what she writes, because her texts are really vulnerable, honest, and, you know, she deals with traumatic topics. And in order to have a soundscape that can match the weight of the things that she says, it's a really delicate process. And I don't know, having a good musical collaboration is kind of like having a good relationship with somebody. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. Like, it's really intimate, and it happened really organically. There was a call out on the Female Pressure Network, which was basically like, we're looking for pieces for radio. And Obsidian knew that I'd already written this piece called The Bird Clock Opera, which at that time was only 23 minutes long, only 23 minutes. And she said that we should, I told her about this because we're always looking to work together, right? And I told her about this call, and she said, well, why don't we use that piece? And so I started working on it like crazy, because we had a deadline of only about, I think, 2 weeks before it could be submitted. And so I recorded her reading the text that she's already written. She wrote them years ago. And then I reappropriated the piece to fit the mood and the pacing to some of the things that she was saying. So I hope that answers the question enough.
It does. So together with the audio piece that we have just shown, we also showed that slide with two images. Can you tell us? I think you took those double exposure images, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? Because that sounds extremely interesting.
Aw, thank you. I've been an analog photographer for about 13 years. And I use a Mamiya C330. I can bring it over. I always have it.
Oh, no.
So this camera is what I used to create it. Actually, both the images.
So it's a medium format camera?
Exactly. And the black and white photo, for example, is actually a triple exposure. It was an accident. I wanted it just to be a double exposure. But this camera is getting old. And so sometimes I make triples by accident. But the color image was
really nicely, though.
Thank you. And it accidentally mirrored the image of Obsidian. That was a very planned shot. That was when we were doing some of the recordings because we needed to generate promotional material. And so I took the photo of the disco ball in a basement first, and then I placed her from memory in the same frame when I moved the camera over to take the second exposure. So I've been doing double exposures, yeah, for like 12 or 13 years when I first got started, and it's pretty much my obsession. It hasn't stopped.
It sounds pretty tough to line stuff up then. You just go by memory? Do you just take a single shot at it? Or do you like give each picture two or three attempts before you move on to
the next one? I like to get it right in camera. And so if I miss it, then I try again. I had extensive practice with a photographic project from 2013, 2014, where it was all about double exposures and black and white. And some of those I shot three times. And as long as you really have a good memory of where you created the first exposure versus the second exposure, you know, if you take the images consecutively, it can be relatively easy. The difficulty is when you have a an exposure in your camera waiting for like a day or two and you don't remember. But in general, I have a pretty solid approach of like how I compose things. I can't emphasize enough to you how many pictures I've taken in my life ever since I got, yeah, obsessed with analog photography.
Out of curiosity, do you develop the images yourself, or do you do you get them developed?
A good question, because this year I finally joined this darkroom and screen printing collective. Their name is Stadtlab in Berlin. We're over 100 artists, and the point of it is so that you can develop your own black and white photos. I'm mostly a color photographer, but since joining the space, I'm pushing myself to shoot black and white more. So the black and white was developed by me, but the color is harder to deal with. Literally, it's the difference of having the temperature of the water, right? I mean, 21 degrees is pretty easy to, you know, you don't have to worry about heating up the water if you have a good relationship with your faucet. But for color, then you have to meticulously have the right temperature. Because I used to develop color film when I was living in San Francisco years ago, but I haven't done it yet. I'm pacing myself, and I'm putting a lot of energetic focus into planning events as well as just making music.
Your music, the music piece that was part of the art piece that we just showed was honestly quite amazing. I've heard from the other people of the team that they enjoyed listening to it. What does your process in creating a piece of music look like? You said that you readapted it to this art piece specifically, but like how did you go about creating it to start with?
Well, I have a little synthesizer. She's a mini log. She's like, what, this big, a little bit bigger? It's 3 octaves, essentially. So that is a synthesizer that I moved here with. I do everything in Ableton. And the reason why it's called the Bird Clock Opera is you hear a lot of these like robotic bird chirpy sounds. I found a bird clock in Prenzlauer Berg like 2 years ago. And I have a deep love of repurposing trash. And so someone threw that out and I picked it up and I was like, oh my God, I have to sample this. And so I've been sampling it over and over in different tracks. And the original version of that song, I've never performed it live because I have some technical difficulties. I have a very slow laptop, unfortunately. So a 23-minute track, if I'm going to perform that live, I will have some issues with lag with my terrible processing power. But yeah, I do everything in Ableton, and I have probably a sample library of, I don't know, maybe 15 gigabytes. And I'm slowly going through and categorizing, like, okay, this is the pick I like. Okay, this is the hat that I like. And so I've been carving my sound out in my years of being in Berlin and having a lot of time as a freelancer.
So just to circle back on the issues with processing power and lag, does that mean that the music piece just gets stretched out when you perform it live, or how does that work?
Oh yeah. Okay. So I think in order for me to perform it live, I would really have to have one laptop that's just dedicated to some of the samples, right? Because that track probably has 40 different layers, which is a lot more than just a typical like pop song, which normally has more like 13 layers for me. Because I mean, I'm using these plugins, and plugins are always so laggy. And so that's why I'm trying to replicate with the mini log. So if I were to perform it live, which I was really hoping to, but I don't think I can until I get a new computer. Would be having the mini log generating some of those sounds, because some of the sounds in the recording are from the mini log. But in order to reappropriate the piece, I mean, a lot of these tracks that I've created, I compose on the timeline. I don't compose on the clip view, if that makes sense. And so I'm just used to looping things over and over. That's how I approached music when I was like, I used to have a 4-track when I was 16 years old. And that's kind of how I would create music would be. And I had a delay pedal too, that would sometimes just keep things on repeat. And I think that style really influences me now still, because that's how I compose. I hear something over and over in my head. And then, you know, I don't know, it's kind of like dancing as well, where like you kind of wait for the right movements to move. And so I generally had an idea when I was listening to, you know, what she was saying. Okay, like, okay, that makes sense. And, you know, and so when the text gets a little bit more gentle, then I stayed in the same key for the whole piece. That's also helpful. And it's kind of like making informed decisions. Like if I really, for example, there's this one part where if you miss it, I mean, she's talking about the rape of her sister. And so when she starts describing it more, then I finally drop the 4 in the floor beat, which, you know, emphasizes like the heaviness of it. And I think I talked about that in the Q&A, that I was worried that that was too much, but I think it complemented the piece well. And again, I always look to her for cues because it's her piece and I'm trying to make sure that I match. Hope that answers it.
So basically you've got her reading her piece, and then you are basically trying to make the music fit and kind of dance with it to emphasize what she's saying.
Yes. And since this piece was designed for radio, I used to have a radio show back in the States years ago. I know that sometimes having moments of pause and breathing is really important so that people can just like observe and let it sink in. And literally, like, you know, we would broadcast, we were streaming. Sometimes it's good to have a little bit of a delay, like 10 seconds or 15 seconds of just time for it to breathe, so that if people have issues of like tuning in, that's why like the piece also has me talking, saying like, hello, I'm Prism, da-da-da-da, to refresh your memory of like, hey, this is what's happening, like guiding you through it.
So what kind of challenges do you face when you design an art piece to be broadcast as like a radio show? Do you have problems with like the piece just being difficult to understand because of the nature of analog radio, or does that play into it at all?
My biggest fear when we released this was, oh my goodness, I hope I mixed this well enough. Because I wanted to make sure that you could still hear her vocals, but not too loud, but not too low. So I was constantly going through it, listening to the whole thing over and over, making sure that like, okay, you can hear her well enough. And so that was my biggest concern with presenting this piece. I mean, it's really a time issue. We had a deadline to compose this piece. And so I was pretty much just working on this nonstop, like not sleeping. Sometimes you export a 30-minute track and then you realize, oh, I forgot to export the kicks. Damn it. So I'd have to just try it again.
And then you just have to re-export it again.
Oh, it was so annoying, but yeah. You learn to just triple check everything before you press that button.
At least in terms of the mix, I think our audio engineer here was quite happy with you. We talked at the beginning when we were just double checking everything, and they mentioned that the mix was apparently pretty good.
What a relief. I don't have access to a studio at the moment, and I've never had formal training. I've really just been around other musicians, and I've tried to pick up tips from that person, tips from that person. You know, trying to EQ all the tracks well enough. I mean, I'm not like a super pro pop producer, but I mean, I do play live. So I'm used to making sure that, okay, I don't want any clipping, for goodness sake. Like, can't have that.
Yeah, clipping is always a huge pain. When that red light starts to flash and you see, oh no, I've just... Whatever I was doing, it's damaged beyond repair. I need to go back and fix that.
Yeah, I mean, I always put a limiter on all of my, on the master of all my tracks too. That's a really easy way to just like kill it. And of course there's side chaining, but that's not a thing that was really an issue with this track. I mean, designing an ambient piece is kind of easier than designing something that's more, you know, electro or dark wave. That's where I have more issues with clipping usually. But with this, you know, I really wanted it to be, I wanted her vocals to stand out, but again, not too much.
Let me see whether there is questions from the community, because I'm just realizing that I'm kind of nerding out here and just asking questions I'm curious about. I can't see any other questions right now, so I'm just going to circle back to the analog photography. So we've talked about double exposures. What kind of challenges do you face? So obviously double exposure is something that is a thing you can only do with analog photography. You can imitate it
not
with digital
true.
Photography. Oh, tell me more about that then. I didn't know that you could properly do that with digital.
You can. There are, first, I don't know, because I have I'm a Nikon person. But a long time ago, I started out on Canon, right? But I switched to Nikon because you can change the lenses interchangeably. And that's a huge plus for me. I have like 7 Nikon lenses from 15 millimeter to 180. I love Nikon. I love the old heavy glass. But with certain cameras, there's literally a double exposure setting. And I never do it on my D750, but I think on like the Mark II, you can do it. But also, there's another camera that I use. It's called a Hiranizumi 4. It is very special, and it's a toy camera, and that also has a double exposure function. So it's not the same as shooting analog for sure, because it just isn't. Like, you don't have to worry about configuring your exposure for the first image as much, because it kind of does it automatically. Like, you basically create an image and then you create a second one on top of it. So I guess the same principles of like, okay, is there going to be enough contrast in this image? Because that's usually the problem when people try and make double exposures, is that they're like, oh, look at this beautiful picture of the sky. And like, the sky is like this, you know, it generally, like if it's a beautiful sunset, it's like medium gray. You need like some darkness in order for the other exposure to come through.
Need something like a sunset with a bunch of clouds on in front of it that's blocking like half the sunset.
Exactly. And it needs to be dark enough. Like, but I've had some, I've done actually film swaps with people for, I don't know, 7 years now, where I shoot a roll and then I mail it to someone and then they shoot on top of it or vice versa. And my advice to them is always like, luckily I shoot at night, so I have a lot of contrast in general. Usually I have, you know, darkness and then bright pops of color, and that works really well for double exposures. But a lot of the people that I work with, they're more like daytime photographers. So some of the exposures have come out really well and some of them have not.
Because you need both images to be kind of contrasty and punchy.
You do. And when you're shooting analog, then you definitely have to think about how you're rating your film. And I've tried to explain to people, I'm like, okay, we're shooting on an ISO 400, right? But you need to rate it like it's ISO 800. So there's, you know, room for the other photo to come through. And I think sometimes people overthink it. They think they should be shooting at 200, or they don't change it at all. But, you know, the color negative film is much more forgiving than positive.
How does, like, color positive film, do you shoot with color positive film, or do you just prefer negatives?
I shoot every type of film. And when I shoot color positive film, I have to, first of all, make the decision of how old is this film, because I use a lot of expired film. I think about the roll firsthand, about whether or not I want to cross-process. Most of the time, lately, I've been cross-processing because I'm really lucky. I have this really beautiful selection of EPT that's like 20 years old. And usually when you have the lower ISO, you know, it it doesn't degrade as fast. But I love the crazy color contrast, which is not color contrast, color shifts that happen, which is very different from most of the people that I work with. Most of the people that I work with at Stadtlab, the screen printing darkroom space, you know, they're classic photographers for the most part. They're not as experimental as I am, but that's the whole joy of it for me, that I don't know what I'm going to get, you know, but that's why I do it. I'm so excited to do, you know, explosions of color and see which one shows up. So yeah, I shoot everything.
So then until you develop your, so you shoot, not only do you shoot analog where you don't see what kind of photos you've taken until you develop them, but also you shoot with expired film, which makes it kind of like even you really have to guess and play around to figure out what kind of photo you're going to get out of a roll of film.
That's yes.
Film from the same batch, that is, like, if you have film that has been expired for 10 years, but it's all from the same batch, do they usually degrade the same way? Or do you have two different rolls of film and they will degrade in a completely different way?
It depends on the ISO of the film. I mean, I've found that, like, 400 ISO degrades so much more quickly. And there was one time where I shot actually ISO 3200 that was color. I've never seen that roll of film ever since. And that was moldy and it was beautiful. But usually if you get it in the same batch and it's the same ISO, and like, again, it has to be uniform across the board. You know, if I get a batch of film from somebody and it's not all been cold stored, then I can't predict it. But the batch that I have now has been stored all the same way. And I'm not doing as good of a job as I could storing it. Like, I've had to move a couple times since I've gotten this batch. But at the moment, it's in a fridge, which is where it should be, as long as it doesn't get wet. Ugh, that's a disaster.
How does mold kind of affect the image? Do you get dark spots, or does it affect the color in any way?
Yes. Mold shows up as, like, sometimes these weird blotches, kind of like you have, you know, when you're looking at a microscopic image and you see amoebas, where it's like these amorphous blobs. Sometimes you see shapes like that, and it's kind of, it is a little bit transparent, but also you'll see specks. But the 3200 speed film that I was describing, all of that showed up as pink, which is a crazy color. Like, most of the time when film is degrading, usually it's faded, or I don't know, there's like wavy variations. Like, if you have x-rayed film, right, then you have this horrible band that comes across. But no, that one roll of film was pink. And I had some Sensia once that the spot showed up as blue, actually. So it's just wild and unpredictable. So I get really excited anytime someone has some really old film. Yeah.
That sounds amazing and honestly like a lot of fun to play around with. I think that's it in terms of questions. I'm just going to check whether we've got any other questions. Thank you very much for coming to answer questions. Thank you very much for your submission of your art piece. It was really enjoyable. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. And Obsidian says thank you as well. I think she just stopped driving.